Well, good morning, TNC family, on this third Sunday in June, where today here, we continue our annual summer series centered around authors and their brand new writing surrounding a life of faith and the things of God and the stories and the teachings of the scriptures. This is our seventh year of the summer reading series, each year exploring new books published in the last 12 months, books getting wide audience, being read, considered, talked about, and applied by tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and in some cases, millions of people, well-known, well-respected, peer-reviewed authors who are truly influencing our broader culture amid real-life, everyday challenges and opportunities. The book list, many of you know, we released several weeks ago, and you can check it out on the website or at the weekend service. But now, let's jump into the second book, written by Dale Allison, the historian and professor of New Testament at Princeton Theological Seminary, with a master's degree and PhD in religion from Duke University. He was born in 1955 in Wichita, Kansas, making him 69 years old. He and his wife have been married for 42 years. They have three children. And he is recognized around the world as a leading scholar in historical Jesus studies. He's been called North America's most complete New Testament scholar. His work on Matthew's biography of Jesus is largely considered to be the single most influential commentary on Matthew in the last at least 100 years. He's written over 20 books. The first book I ever read of his was his 2009 book, The Historical Christ and the Theological Jesus, in which there's a paragraph in the introduction that I read and reread and underlined and made notes about in the margins because, well, I'm going to read you the paragraph because here's a world-renowned scholar who's about to say something amazingly humble. Again, from the introduction to his 2009 book, quote, "Whatever one makes of these pages, they are the stammerings, neither of an apologist nor of a skeptic, but instead of an oft-confused Protestant who has come to his conclusions, modest as they are, quite gradually, and who may alter tomorrow his uncertain mind about much. Of two things only I feel assured. The first is that as unchanging things do not grow, rocks remain rocks, informed changes of mind should be welcomed, not feared. The second is this, the unexamined Christ is not worth having." And I wrote in the margins, "humility!" And "curiosity!" And if there's nothing else we gain from today, I pray it will be a recommitment to these two Christ-like attributes, humility and curiosity. In 2010, he published another book called Constructing Jesus, Memory, Imagination, and History, a book that won awards exploring how does memory work when we're trying to reconstruct something from the past? And how did the biographers of Jesus, writing decades after Jesus' life, remember and then retell things? I also want to mention his 2021 book, The Resurrection of Jesus, Apologetics, Polemics, History. In my view, the best book ever written on the historical and textual problems surrounding the resurrection. William Lane Craig, the highly regarded conservative Christian apologist, theologian, philosopher, has said, quote, "It is one of the most impressive pieces of work I have read in this field. Allison forced me, as no one else has, to rethink the evidence for Jesus' resurrection afresh. I've never seen a more persuasive case for skepticism about the historicity of Jesus' resurrection than Allison's presentation of the arguments, a book, TNC, in which he still comes in the end to affirm the evidence for death, burial, empty tomb, and claims of post-mortem appearances, and that a belief in the resurrection is both reasonable and actually a conclusion based on inference to the best explanation." But my favorite book of Allison's is probably his 2016 book, Night Comes, a series of meditations on death and what might lie beyond the grave. And by the way, if you watch an interview with him on YouTube, you'll see he has a fun, unique, blunt, humble, kind, and gracious, very conversational style. And finally, one other very interesting biographical fact about him, something that I do not personally relate to, but he's written about this in many places, and I will just read to you his own words. This is from page 153 of today's book, which I'll introduce to you in a second. Again, his words, quote, "I believe I have on two occasions foreseen in detail specific events before they came to pass. One time a few hours before, the other 2 weeks before. I also firmly believe that I was once present when an object moved of its own accord from one side of a room to the other, and I am inclined to believe that a woman 3 days dead once awakened me in the middle of the night to comfort me, and further that one afternoon a few weeks later, she spoke to me out of the blue, telling me to do something immediately." He goes on, "Perhaps I should be reticent to confide all of this. Maybe I will be academically ostracized and lose my accreditation. I am keenly aware that claims such as mine evoke strong resistance or even ridicule, but it would be dishonest to run from what I've seen." Okay, his brand new book is called Interpreting Jesus, which is just 6 chapters long, and each one is kind of an independent essay. Jesus and women. Jesus and miracles, Jesus and Moses, Jesus and the last things, Jesus and how historians have approached scholarship about him. Just 6 chapters, but if you get to the very end, including exploring his sources, you're pushing 500 pages, so beware. And because each chapter is an independent essay, in my opinion, there's not a main theme to the book. You can start wherever you want. It's more like some very interesting perspectives on Jesus, who is history's most interesting and important figure. And I love the very first words of the entire book because they reflect his curiosity and humility and sense of humor. Again, the book is called Interpreting Jesus, and he begins, "After completing Constructing Jesus in 2010, which I firmly believed would be my last book on the historical Jesus, I said to my wife, 'Honey, I'm done with Jesus.' Her immediate response was, 'He'll be glad to hear that.'" He goes on, "But I was wrong. I have been unable to stay away." And then again, acknowledging his own uncertainties, his humility about what he's going to write in the book, he quotes Alasdair MacIntyre, "The only apology that I can offer for writing so incompletely and inconclusively is that it is preferable to writing conclusively and mistakenly." And today, TNC, because each chapter does stand alone, I just want to comment on chapter 3, a chapter on Jesus's miracles, that begins with acknowledging that almost everybody who tries to explain or account for the miracle stories in the Gospels takes one of two strategies. First is the strategy of the skeptic, who says, "Miracles, they don't happen. Therefore, the biblical stories are either made-up fiction or scientific ignorance." But then you have a second strategy, which is the strategy of the traditional Christian, which is simply to assume that the miracles took place as recorded and that the obvious explanation is God. God intervened in the normal order of things and did something outside of what is repeatable, observable science, physics, chemistry, biology, and so on. Which leaves us with a sort of all or nothing approach. Either it's God everywhere or nothing everywhere. And both positions are dissatisfying to Allison, both because of his own life experience and from his work as a historian, in which he basically says, "Look, I've investigated enough history and interviewed enough people in my life to see that unusual, weird, seemingly miraculous things, they do happen." And then in the chapter, he spends a fair bit of time using the example of Jesus's transfiguration to make the point. The transfiguration, some of you know, occurs in Matthew, Mark, and Luke's biographies. And broadly speaking, it's when Jesus goes up on a mountain and then Jesus levitates and glows. There's a bunch of light surrounding him. Listen briefly to Mark's account, chapter 9, verses 2 and 3. Quote, "After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up to a high mountain where they were all alone. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could bleach them. And Matthew also tells this story, chapter 17. Matthew says, quote, his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became dazzling white. Luke also tells the story and says, quote, the appearance of his face changed, and his clothes became dazzling white. At which point the skeptic would say, okay, well, maybe Jesus' disciples hallucinated, or maybe it was a dream that they turned into something that really happened, or maybe the morning sun rose behind Jesus while he stood on a mountain, and his sleepy, gullible followers awakened to behold the sight. Or maybe the disciples just made up the story because the ancient Jewish scriptures said that Moses glowed, and Jesus has to be like Moses or greater than Moses, so let's make up the story. Whatever the case, the skeptics say, we must look to explain unusual, complex phenomenon by leaning into simpler, more often observed causes or explanations for why people see unusual stuff. On the other hand, you have Christians who would just say, well, Jesus was divine and God is light, and here's a manifestation of Jesus' divinity. That would be a theological explanation. Now, Allison has a problem with both perspectives, because he says, we know from both history and science that unusual things happen, and they're neither made up nor are they signs of divinity. For example, he says, we know from science that our world is multidimensional, and from quantum physics that, in the words of Einstein, spooky stuff does happen. And there are forces operating within our world that we just don't understand. And Allison says, if you know your history, there are credible examples of people who glow or levitate. It's just not a one-of-a-kind event. After which, Allison walks the reader through dozens and dozens and dozens of examples of stories of people who glow and levitate, including in Roman Catholic canonization records, and beyond this, in the records of Sufi masters who glow or Tibetan masters who glow. He tells the story of a friend who told him the story of how one afternoon he was in a room with another spiritual leader, and the leader just started out of nowhere glowing, and then got brighter and brighter and brighter, and light filled the room, and then without any explanation, it just sort of simply died back. Allison goes on to say, the guy who saw this is a friend of mine, somebody I talked to, and who I interviewed about it as an historian and made a judgment about his credibility. And then Allison tells a story of his own son, who several years ago, alongside some friends, had an audience with a Tibetan holy man, a 90-year-old revered figure, and as they're sitting there talking to this guy through a translator, the Tibetan holy man starts glowing. And Allison writes, my son is a modern person, likely to first assume it's an illusion or a misinterpretation of optic phenomenon, something like that. But, as my son tells it, he looks around and thinks, what the blank is going on? I don't understand this. But then, he decides after a little bit, no, this guy is glowing, and he doesn't say anything about it until, of course, he gets out of the room, and he says to his friends, did you see what I saw? And they all say, yeah, we saw this guy glowing. All right, TNC, that's bizarre. And I'm personally inclined to think, ah, hallucinogenics were involved, magic mushrooms, or sleight of hand. But Allison says, no, none of that. And then he goes on to make a compelling case that when you do the research, turns out things like this are not rare experiences. People do have such experiences, however you or someone else wants to account for them. All of these people across cultures and geographies and decades and centuries, they have had them. And then Allison goes on to say, look, if one has enough of these stories and if they check out with the historical method and so on, then we ought to at least consider looking at the miracle stories in the Gospels through that lens. A lens which says, I can't prove that it happened, but if it did happen, it would not astound me. It actually fits into this type of event, making it neither anti-science nor proof of divinity. Rather, it's something that just does happen. And Allison applies the same perspective to about 24 cases in the scriptures where Jesus predicts the future or heals an individual and so on. Again, Allison remains both humble and curious, and just makes the point. Look, this stuff isn't unprecedented. He says even Abraham Lincoln, he points out, 3 days before he was murdered, reportedly dreamed of his body lying in state in the East Room, and he heard someone say, "Our president was killed by an assassin." Point is, such stories are not many, but they are there. And Allison concludes, quote, "So what I'm getting at here is that I think you can argue for the plausible historicity of a number of things in the Gospels that skeptics just dismiss because they're supernatural, or that Christians just instantly say, oh, that's God. It must have been God." He says, "But I don't think we have to fall into either camp." And in this one chapter alone, TNC, he has 257 other sources, not kidding. Said another way, this is a book of rigorous history, and one of the sources is actually G.K. Chesterton, who some of you know was one of the most prolific writers of the 20th century, born in 1874, died in 1936, friend of C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. Chesterton wrote about faith and philosophy, mystery, biography, poetry, social and political commentary, wrote almost 100 books, wrote over 4,000 newspaper essays. He had a reputation for being a deep thinker, also one deeply filled with joy and life. And Chesterton, at one point, chastised the church for using miracles as a key component of trying to convince others of Christianity. Chesterton said that asking people to believe in miracles is not asking people to believe in something so incredible. It is asking them to be converted by something commonplace. And Allison goes on to point out that the idea that everything ought to be comprehensible to humans, and therefore that nothing can exist that is not comprehensible to humans, is just simply bereft of intelligent thinking. Of course, things happen that we don't understand. And his main point in this essay is just to say, hey, it will be strange for most people, but you can argue for the history of at least a good body of this stuff without having theological convictions about it. And there you have it, TNC. What a chapter. Probably his most challenging and out there chapter, and certainly a set of ideas and phenomena that I have no significant personal experience with. But can we be humble? Can we listen to the experiences of others? Can we look at miracle stories from the position of a historian? That's what Allison does. And he does the same with each of these independent chapters, looking at the connection of Jesus with Moses, with women, with the final days of Earth history. And in each chapter, largely, he explores what it would mean to challenge the status quo thinking. Which leads me to end now with a final quotation from the book. Again, a quote calling us to appropriate humility and curiosity. This is from page 322. Quote, "I may be wrong about any number of things. I do not dwell in the land of unwavering conviction. I regularly wonder what I've missed and whether better thoughts are to be had. While I favor certain ideas, I am not welded to them, and I hope, even after all my years in the field, to learn more tomorrow." Let's pray. God, I pray for every person listening. I pray that you would give us genuine humility and limitless curiosity. What great qualities. Now, TNC, I pray that the Lord would bless you and keep you, would make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you, would turn his face toward you and give you peace. Amen.